everybody. I'm Debbie Newman, I'm the Events Director for Sierra Nevada College. Pleased to see you all here, and this is one of the first collaborative events UC Davis and SNC have done together, and we're really pleased that we've had fun working together. Couple of things, if you can turn off your cell phones, we'd greatly appreciate that. We've got some clipboards floating around if you'd like to get information about upcoming events either from UC Davis or SNC. We don't sell our lists or anything, we just pray between each other since you're here for a joint event. So we would love to have your name and email so we can keep you abreast of what's happening on the campus. And I'll turn it over to Heather.
Great, thanks and welcome to everyone. So my name is Heather Segalli. I'm the Education and Outreach Director for the UC Davis Tahoe Environmental Research Center. And we host monthly lectures here at the Tahoe Center for Environmental Sciences on various topics related to the environment, related to science, related to issues that are important. And so if you would like to get on our mailing list, make sure you give us your email address. And if you do get emails from us, you have the ability to just use the footer at the bottom of the email to change the number of things that you're receiving. We send things out for our monthly lectures, our technical workshops and conferences, our K-12 environmental education events, etc. Our next lecture is going to be on March 22nd, and it's related to climate change in the oceans with an internationally renowned climate scientist, Dr. Howie Spiro, also from UC Davis. But tonight, I would like to welcome Professor and Dr. Dan Sperling, who is with the UC Davis Department of Civil Engineering and Environmental Science and Policy. He is also the founding director of the Institute for Transportation Studies at UC Davis, and author of over 200 technical papers and 12 books, including the book that has this the title of this lecture, which is 2 Billion Cars Driving Towards Sustainability. And I saw him on Daily Show with Jon Stewart, so another claim to fame. And his books are here, so if you would like to purchase his book at the end of the lecture, they're here and you could get that signed. And Tobias over there is holding one up and has them available in the box of those, so if anyone's interested. But let's please give a warm welcome to Dr. Dan Sperling.
Student, I was involved with an organization that was Friends of Tahoe or something, where we were coming up with a transportation plan. We were going to have rails, a light rail around the lake. I think people are still talking about that quite a few years later. I also spent two winters here skiing, most of two winters, so this is a place I'd like to come. So I really am pleased to be here. And so you see here my subtitle. There's the word regulator in here. And so one thing that Heather left off from my intro is that I serve on the California Air Resources Board. I'm a board member for the California Air Resources Board. And how many of you have heard of CARB? Is that good news or bad news? I've heard people say it's the most powerful agency in California, and usually the ones that saying it are not meaning it as a compliment. But so I have a lot of experience both on the policy side as well as the academic side, and it's partly from that point of view I'll be talking to you today. So just a little background. So this is the Institute of Transportation Studies that I head up at UC Davis, and we do all kinds of studies of transportation. In many ways, we're probably the leading university center for the study of sustainable transportation in the country. We do a lot of work with environmental aspects, electric vehicles, and in fact, my co-author, or my co-presenter, I was supposed to be here, Tom Turrentine, we were very much looking forward to it, because we had a whole show that we were going to do, playing off of each other and entertaining you, but unfortunately there's a death in his family, his mother-in-law passed away. She had been ill for a long time, but he couldn't make it. So you have just me, but he heads up the Electric Vehicle Center. And so within ITEA, within the Institute, we have a vehicle center. We have a center that looks at energy, alternative energy, more generally, energy efficiency, urban land use. So we do a lot of work. And for any young people in the audience, if you're thinking about graduate school and interested in environment, transportation, energy, this is a place to go. He says modestly. So this is the book, and there has to be, you know, where did this 2 billion car number come from? So this is a graph that shows how many vehicles there are in the world. So in terms of actual cars and light trucks, this is how many. But then there's a lot of trucks and buses, and then there's a lot of motorcycles, and they all use fuel and produce pollution. And so you can see where we are in 2012 now. We're up to about 1.3 billion vehicles in the world. Billion. A lot. But as scary as that might sound, look at the slope for what's expected to happen. So this is kind of the business as usual, the conventional consensus forecast of number of vehicles in the world. And look how steep it goes up. And most of those vehicles are not in the US. We're pretty saturated, but there's China, India, and Indonesia, and a lot of other places, Latin America, Russia, that we're at really high growth rates. So it's kind of like, if you think we've got a problem now in terms of oil use, oil dependence, greenhouse gases, it's only going to get a lot worse unless we do something about this. So just to leave a vivid image in your mind of what this all means, I could ask you where this is. Anyone think of it? Los Angeles, 4 or 5 freeway. How about the younger people in the crowd? I think you would have better views of it. Look at it carefully. I heard it over there. It's photoshopped.
Yeah.
If you look, there's a lot of cars that keep reappearing, and a lot of lanes of vehicles that keep reappearing. So, this is the cover of Time magazine 6 years ago, about climate change and how serious it is. And it's only, from that point, it's only gotten a lot worse. There's a lot more greenhouse gases being emitted in the world, a lot more vehicles, and the climate science is a lot more certain about the impacts of all that greenhouse gas and all that carbon dioxide that's coming in and the effect on the climate. And kind of just as part of this introduction, this is to make you feel a little better, a little more optimistic. So there's Saudi Arabia. You know, Saudi Arabia has been not the most progressive country in the world, not only on dealing with climate issues, but a lot of others, as you know. But this is the minister, the oil minister of Saudi Arabia, the person that deals with all this. And he gave a speech just a few weeks ago in London. And this is what he said. And this is really remarkable because what it tells us is that outside of a little piece of Washington, D.C., where certain politicians seem to dwell, there is growing, let's say in the informed communities of the world, there's growing understanding and appreciation that climate change is very real, humans are the cause of it, and something has to be done about it. It's kind of like when it gets to the oil minister of Saudi Arabia, this is now well accepted wisdom. Now I'm actually on sabbatical, I'm just out here in California for a few days. I'm on sabbatical in Washington, D.C. So I know what I'm talking about.
Did you take that place or did you get sent there?
Get banished there. I went there because, not because I wanted to see the politicians in action, but to understand, you know, the policy process better. And I am involved, you'll see some of the things I'm going to talk about is taking some of the ideas that we've developed here in California, some of the policies here, and seeing if we can bring them to Washington, you know, some of the different policy instruments and policy approaches. So if you have it, so actually, feel free to ask questions anywhere along the way. You know, there's lots of interesting topics. I'm even willing to digress along the way a little bit. We've got plenty of time here, so I want you to enjoy it, feel engaged. But so what I am going to talk about is transportation and energy and climate. And as I indicated before, climate change is really becoming a more severe challenge, and it's becoming more certain that we need to do something about it. And transportation's a big part of the climate problem and a big part of the oil problem. Transportation accounts for, in the world, accounts for half of all the oil consumed. But in the United States, it accounts for 2/3 of all the oil consumed in the U.S. So to the extent there's an oil problem, it's a transportation problem. And transportation also accounts for close to 1/3 of all the greenhouse gases, CO2 and greenhouse gases in the U.S. So transportation is a big part of the problem, and therefore has to be a big part of the solution. So another way of looking at that is we can't go on the way we've really got to change the transportation system. We've got to transform the transportation system. And a simple way of thinking about it is I present it as there's a three-legged stool. And I'll show you the stool in a moment. But it's three legs are the vehicles, the fuels, and the mobility, the users, us. And we have to make major changes in all of those if we're going to create a world that, you know, doesn't head towards some kind of cataclysmic, catastrophic end. And I'm going to tie this together a little bit in talking about it in terms of what California's done. So California, as many of you know, pioneered car-centric living in cities, car dependence. And, you know, maybe because we did that, or maybe because in California we went so far, you know, to one extreme, there's been a realization of that. And now there's actually some of the most innovative, progressive policies dealing with transportation changing are coming out of California. And so the Air Resources Board that I sit on as a board member, I hold the transportation seat on the Air Board. And that is what we're tackling, is the transportation sector, as well as others, but I focus on transportation. So in California, I know we're not in California, but we're close. In California, about 37% of all the greenhouse gases are from transportation. You know, nationally, it's about 33%. And then you see where all the rest come from. So there's my three-legged stool. And representing the vehicles, the fuels, and the users. VMT is vehicle miles traveled. So that's just a metric we use to measure how much travel is taking place in vehicles. And you see the VMT leg, the people leg, is a little crooked and weak. And what that's intended to represent is that's where we're having the most difficulty, the greatest challenge in dealing with user behavior and use of vehicles and so on. So to kind of characterize as a graphical way of saying that as we go forward in the transportation sector, we're finding that the greatest potential for change, and that means in terms of reducing oil use, reducing pollution, reducing greenhouse gases, is by changing the vehicle. And I say there's the greatest potential for that because we are developing the technology. The technologies are being commercialized, electric vehicles, hybrid vehicles. How many here own a hybrid or electric vehicle? It's an environmental way.
Yeah.
Probably a, 10%, 15%, that's pretty good. Higher than the average. So the vehicle, so there's a lot happening with vehicles, and there's going to be a lot more I'm going to talk about in the moment. Vehicles are going to be changing a lot in the coming years. And it's not, and the vehicles are changing, one, because we've come to appreciate, we, especially the auto industry, has come to appreciate there really is a lot of technology out here that's not very expensive, that can be used to reduce the carbon footprint of the vehicles relatively easily. And so what we see going forward is we have the policies in place, the technology there, the automobile industry is now on board, and that by itself is a huge turnaround. When I started writing that book, the motivation for that book was I was just angry at the automobile industry, mostly the Detroit companies, because they had blocked all energy policies and greenhouse gas policies dealing with transportation for 25 years. And I'll give you some numbers on that in a moment. They blocked it. So when I started working on the book around 2006 or 2007, I said, we've got to bring attention to this. We've got to change it. So that really got me motivated to write the book. But now it turns out that they're fully on board. And I'll talk to you a little bit about it. It's really remarkable, the auto industry. They're not the bad guys anymore. So that's where we're seeing the most change, the most hope. The fuels is a lot more problematic. Trying to get vehicles that run out of electricity or biofuels, we're making very little progress. We're making a little bit. That's why the box is smaller. The lips is smaller. And then the mobility policies in terms of changing our behavior, getting us to drive less. We're making progress there, but even less than it's the most challenging. So here's the vehicles. So this is what I was telling you about. This is from the early 80s all the way up until 2005 or so. There was basically no change in the fuel consumption of vehicles. The fuel economy, the miles per gallon, basically didn't change for 20, 25 years. And it didn't change because, at least on a policy perspective, the industry was blocking every effort to introduce more aggressive fuel economy standards. And that changed. And it changed the source, the motivation, the catalyst really came out of California. In 2002, the state of California passed a law that said that the fuel economy and the greenhouse gases of the vehicles must be improved by 30%, by 30 to 40% by 2016. And as I told you about the auto industry, they weren't very excited about these kinds of policies. And so they fought against it. They sued California. But it wasn't only California, it was 10 other states adopted it. There's a law in the U.S. that says for air pollution in vehicles, it says California, that there's a federal standard for vehicle emissions pollution established by the EPA and the Congress. So everyone has to follow it. But it said, but if California wants to do something more aggressive, they can do it. And if they do it, every other state has a choice of either following California or following the national one. They can't come up with a third standard. So what happened is at this around this time, other states started adopting California. So there's 10 states. Now there's 10 states that follow California's lead on these vehicle emissions and greenhouse gases and pollution. So anyway, so the car companies, they started suing not only California, but the other states, and trying to block it. And I was intimately involved in it. I was an expert witness. They actually went and sued Vermont, because they thought Vermont, they don't have any money, they don't have any real lawyers there. They'll bring in their three-piece suit lawyers from Chicago and New York. And and you know, easily win. Well, they got, they lost, and they lost just, they got trounced. The judge wrote a 150-page decision that repudiated every single argument they made. So, but then, so this is partly a story on how policy is made. You know, that's partly what, you know, that was the part about policy wonk. So I really got excited about, you know, if we're going to change things, we've got to change policy. So the other part of it was that, so they lost all the lawsuits, but then California has to formally get approval from EPA to actually adopt these standards. And EPA had always done it for 20 years routinely, would just, you know, check, find. This time, they said no. And this was the Bush administration. So the Bush administration went like, so this is when Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor. So I was very, I had the fortune to be at a press conference that they held in California. It was Jerry Brown, who was the attorney general, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, two guys that are about as different as you can imagine, standing there shoulder to shoulder saying, we will sue, you know? And that was, you know, they were going to sue the federal government, you know, EPA and the Bush administration. So anyway, in the end, it's a very happy ending because the Bush administration did block it, and California did sue. And then when Obama came in, President Obama, he said, not only am I going to approve the waiver and let California and 10 other states do it, but I think it's such a good idea, I want all 50 states to do it. And so they adopted the California standards for the whole country, which are now in effect. And that's why our vehicles are becoming very much more efficient, you know, every year now. And so that was through 2016. And now we have new standards that California just adopted, Power Air Resources for, going through 2025. And they go, it said, as it says up there, we're going to be at 54 miles per gallon in 2025. So we just adopted this a few weeks ago. That represents a 4 to 5% improvement every year. And so this is dramatic. I mean, given, you know, remember, it didn't change for 25 years, and now we're going 4 or 5% a year. That's really remarkable. Yeah.
And maybe you're going to get into this, not just to any fire or anything, but bring up standards like this, 50 plus miles to the gallon or something like that. I mean, we can change our culture and those kinds of things, but we still have infrastructure to deal with. And we still have to transport goods, and someday maybe we'll get back to manufacturing in this country and doing our own types of goods and those kinds of things. With that, and the lack of funding with a bill that's been through, I don't know how many continuing resolutions, how do we pay for this infrastructure so that we can maintain and maybe get back to being a producing type of nation? We can change our processes and culture, but we still have to produce new products.
Okay, that's a good question, but that's digressing even further than I would. Yeah, at the end, why don't we come back to that? I'm going to talk about that, because that is a good question.
Yeah. Jan, I've always wondered how the fleet-wide average is calculated in different vehicles.
Okay, so let me tell you, that's not a real number. So all of you know when you buy a car and they tell you what the miles per gallon is, and it never is, right? It's off, actually it's off about 20%. It depends how you drive the car and so on, but it's off by basically around 20%. So first of all, that 54 mpg, you gotta knock 20% off of it to see what it really is in the real world. The reason we have these fake numbers, they're not really fake numbers, they're, in a sense, they're scientific numbers because they're generated by having a vehicle go on a test drive, standard drive cycle. So actually, there's a drive cycle that was first developed down in Los Angeles where you would drive out of, it was actually replicating an actual drive. You drive out of this air quality testing building, you go drive down the road, you get on a freeway, and they actually, you know, you stop at a stop sign and so on. So they replicate that. But the problem was, is that when they did that, the speed limit was 55 miles per hour. We drive a little faster now. And if you know, those of you that have fuel economy gauges in your car, you know that when you get over 55, that fuel consumption just starts plummeting. And yet that's how we drive. So that's one of the reasons why it's not really what it says. But they are a standardized number. So this is, so the remarkable story is about the auto industry. You know, the industry that I was so angry at for all those years. And now this is where, you know, last July, where all these are the CEOs of all the major car companies. They sat there, they stood there with President Obama with a smile on their face and said, you know, we are fully behind this 54 mile per gallon standard in 2025. Even 2 years ago, that would have been inconceivable, absolutely inconceivable. And it's really remarkable. So we're going to be seeing vehicles that are getting much more efficient every year. Every new model that comes out is going to be probably about 20% better than the previous model. New F-150, you know, pickup truck, is going to be 20% more efficient than the previous version. And, you know, new ones come out every 4 or 5 years. So that's kind of the pattern we're going to be seeing in all the vehicles into the foreseeable future. Now, you know, again with my policy wonk hat on, you say, oh wow, we won the battle, we won the war, you know, this is great news. The problem, it's not. That's not the end of the story with vehicles. And that is because there is lots of technology that companies can use, turbochargers, direct injection, better transmissions, more aerodynamic. And they're putting all of that in the vehicles, but they're doing it with still with conventional vehicles with gasoline engines. I mean, it's remarkable that they're getting the improvements, but if we're really concerned about oil imports, and especially if we're really concerned about CO2 and climate, we've got to do better than 54 MPG. We've got to get off gasoline. And so what California has done is adopt also a zero-emission vehicle mandate. Now, this has had a long, tortured life, this mandate. Some of you that might have followed it. It was first adopted in 1990 by our Air Resources Board. And it originally called for 2% zero-emission vehicles, 2% of vehicles being sold be zero-emission by 1998, and 10% in 2003. Well, you might notice we are nowhere near 2%, never mind 10%, and it's way past that. So it's read a very tortured life in lawsuits, and you know, it just didn't work. The batteries didn't improve fast enough. And so we had to keep changing the rules to kind of make adjustments, and we started giving credit for hybrid vehicles, and very good gasoline became a mess. So, but now, the batteries have improved. The industry is more responsive. The industry does now accept the notion that we eventually have to get off gasoline, and as well as making vehicles much more efficient. And so we have the zero emission vehicle mandate, which is meant to jumpstart, kickstart, accelerate the investments in the electric vehicles, battery electric vehicles, plug-in hybrids, fuel cell. Yes?
So if you convert to electricity, isn't the majority of electricity produced by coal? Isn't that more than gasoline? So how do they say it's zero emissions?
Okay, so I'm speaking with my regulator hat on, not my academic hat on. With my academic hat on, I say you're exactly right. But from a regulatory perspective, we're starting out, we're just looking at the vehicle, we draw a circle around the vehicle, and call the vehicle itself zero emissions. And I'm going to get to this problem of actually looking at the full life cycle emissions. But there's two answers to what you said. First of all, in some areas, like California, there's very little coal use. And there's a lot of hydroelectric, there's a lot of nuclear, most of the rest is natural gas, and just a tiny bit of coal. And so, in fact, the electricity carbon footprint of electricity system in California is very small. And it's true for a number of other places. I don't know what it is in Nevada. Anyone know how much coal is used in Nevada?
80%.
A lot.
California's not even.
All right. So, okay. So the second part of what the second part of the answer is that. So there's some places where it's already low carbon. The other part is that we are in the U.S. and the world going to be reducing the amount of coal we use, making the coal more efficient and clean, you know, making a cleaner, lower carbon system, even when you use coal. And so it's partly we got to have faith that that part of the process moves forward because of regulations and policy and so on. And it is happening. So by the time we have a lot of electric vehicles, hopefully the electricity system will be much lower carbon than it is. That's not, other people are fighting that battle. I'm speaking of the vehicle part of the battle. So we have the zero emission vehicle program. We have some other incentives also. There's a federal incentive. If you buy an electric car, there's a you get a $7,500 tax credit when you buy it. And there's other incentives. You know, some places, like in California, if you have an electric car, you can go in a carpool lane, which actually people consider more important than in California, more important than any tax credit. And so this is kind of a slide to emphasize what I said a moment ago, that if we're really headed towards a future of low oil, low carbon, and that is the policy in California, in Europe, in Australia, in a lot of countries. I mean, in the U.S. here, we're getting a perverted sense of what the world thinks because, you know, there's this small part of one party in Washington that is very hostile to regulation, environmental controls, and so on. But almost everywhere else in the world, the vast majority of the world is moving towards more carbon policies and carbon reductions. So in any case, so here's where when we look to 2050, we say, okay, how do we get to this future in terms of vehicles? And to get to that large reduction, this is a scenario that we did that we used from the California Air Resources Board as the basis for the policies that we adopted from the Zero Emission Vehicle Program. And we said by 2050, we need to have about 80% of the vehicles being pure battery electrics, PEV, pure battery electrics, or fuel cell vehicles running on hydrogen. There'll be a few that are plug-in hybrids. Does everyone know what a plug-in hybrid is? Okay, so most of you know. Think of it as a Prius, where it gets some of its electricity from a plug. So now, right now, a Prius gets all of its electricity from gasoline. The next step, Toyota is actually going to start selling one. The General Motors Volt, the Chevy Volt, is a plug-in hybrid, because it gets some of its power from electricity. And then some standard old gasoline hybrids will probably still be around, can be part of this. But conventional gasoline vehicles, will be gone by that time, almost gone by that time. So we figured, how did we get there? We went back to, 2015, 2025, how much it would have to be, and that's how we designed these standards. And what it is what we're requiring is that, as part of the rules that we just adopted a month ago, in 2025, in California, there'll be about 1.5 million of these zero-emission vehicles, near zero-emission vehicles, accounting for about 15% of the vehicles on the road. Yes?
Getting the emissions for a moment, what's the economic cost of running a car like a zero-emission?
Well, today it's very expensive. So I know there's a number of you that have electric vehicles. You know they're expensive to buy them. You're asking to run them. So the vehicle costs more, but the energy is much less. Right, to run them is much cheaper. It depends if you have using off peak rates or where you are and so on. But it's,
miles per gallon.
Yeah, but it's
miles per.
It's less megawatt. Less than half as much cost. Okay. Fourth to a half as much cost for the electricity as for the electric vehicle owner.
And the maintenance is a lot less.
And the maintenance is what?
The maintenance is considerably less on an electric vehicle versus gas.
That's right. So with an electric vehicle, you have essentially no moving parts. And so you don't have all those liquids, parts, and mechanical. So the maintenance will be a lot less as well.
Yes. So when you say that, does that include the recycling or the you have to replace the batteries in the hybrid too? Because that comes up pretty quickly, 60,000 miles. So that's $4,000 or $5,000.
Well, it should not be at 60,000 miles. In fact, they're warranted for 80 or 100, yeah. And in fact, some of the others will be warranted for more than that. For the batteries are clearly very expensive. The batteries are clearly the most expensive part of the vehicle. And the future of electric vehicles. So the future of electric vehicles is, you know, it's unclear how it's going to play out. So like in this scenario, you see that California developed the ARB, it's that fuel cell is bigger than the electric vehicles. It could be the other way around. It could be this could be all electric and fuel cells would be a small part of it. We don't know how much progress is going to be made with batteries. And the batteries are getting better every year. You know from your laptops, you know, every generation is better, but you also know from your laptops and your other, you know, iPads and so on, that there's still a problem. You know, they still don't last very long. You know, in fact, in those devices, they only last a couple of years, usually. And so the challenge with vehicles is developing these big batteries that last much longer. But, the Toyota has had a huge success, has been very successful with the Prius battery. Those batteries last, and almost always last, way past 100,000. You know, my brother has one that's up to 170,000, and he's still driving it with that battery. So, we'll see. You know, this is part of better and more technology, and that's part of the solution. All right. So then let's go to the. So that's the half. You know, that's actually. I'm going for the best from the best to the worst here. Maybe I should do it another way around. So that was the happy story. Next is the fuels. So, kind of one realization you have to have is that, like this oil. This was an earlier oil minister from Saudi Arabia. He'd been there for 3 decades. And there's this quote attributed to him. And it's a very compelling, important one because there's a whole lot of oil. You know, you read the newspapers, you think we're going to run out of oil, and those of you who've been around for a while, I mean, we've gone through multiple episodes where the end of oil was here. In fact, when I started writing my book a few years ago, you know, I kept going to the bookstore to see, you know, what was being sold. And there are all these books on end of oil and, you know, it was like, and they were all wrong. They're all wrong. There's a lot of oil out there. Part of the problem is, though, that a lot of it is really ugly, dirty. So like the oil sands, the tar sands in Canada, even in California, a lot of the oil is produced as a very heavy tar-like oil. And it takes a lot more energy to process it. But we're going in the direction of using more and more of that uglier, dirtier type oil. And there's huge, huge amounts of it. So the challenge is, so we're not going to use up all the oil. There's no way in the world. There's no way we're ever going to do it. So the challenge is, how do we get off of that sooner rather than later? And the three principal alternatives that almost everyone agrees are that we're going to be moving to in the presentation are the biofuels, different kinds of biofuels. There's some biofuels better than others. Hydrogen, again, there's different kinds of hydrogen because you can make hydrogen from almost anything. And electricity, just like that question before, you can make electricity from almost anything. And, you know, coal and all the way down to solar and wind and so on. So the challenge is, how do we move to these lower carbon renewable energies as we go into the future? Well, if we look at it historically, we've been talking about this. I mean, if you look, it's now a part of history already. It's been going on so long that we've gone through many of these episodes where we were we need an alternative fuel. Either we're running out of oil or we need a cleaner fuel. And you know, over 30 years ago when Jimmy Carter was president, we had this huge Synfuels program, which is the same as what we're talking about now with tar sands, oil sands, heavy oils, using coal to make fuels. So that was a big thing that came and went. Then we got all excited in 1980 about methanol. There were methanol stations on the road, and we had a big program, you know, to get methanol out there. Came and went. Then around early 90s, we got excited about electric vehicles. Came, went. You know. Hydrogen, you might remember George Bush saying back in, I think, 2002 or so, the State of the Union message, where you know, we are addicted to oil and we have to do something about it. And hydrogen is the solution, and a child born today is going to be able to buy and own a hydrogen fuel cell car when they get a driver's license. Well, that hasn't worked out too well either. And then we had corn ethanol 5 or 6 years ago. That was going to save us. And we ended up with lots of corn ethanol, but then we figured out corn ethanol is really not a very good option after all. So we have a lot of it, but it's not doing as much good. So now we're back to electricity again. And the question is, what's next? And the story here is that unless we intervene with policy, the oil industry and society is going to go right back up to the top and start all over again. And Synfuels, now we call unconventional oil and oil sands and tar sands. That's what we're going to do. So we need, so it says, without policy and intervention, I should move this thing. I don't, it's getting in your way here, right? All right, gone. The world just opened. So we would just start over without doing that. So we need to do something about it. And there have, and so these are the options. So I actually put in biofuels, hydrogen, and then compressed natural gas. That's not as, there are some people that are very excited about using natural gas in vehicles. There's a guy, T.G. Pickens, that has been spending a huge amount, millions and millions of dollars, lobbying Congress and everyone else, and ads in the newspapers trying to promote natural gas vehicles. They have certain attraction. They replace oil, which is good, but the amount of carbon emissions are not much better than gasoline. The regular smog-producing pollution is about the same as gasoline, so it's not a big improvement. It's still a fossil fuel, but it's okay. But the other ones are the really good options. And so, so it says there we need flexible performance-based technology. We need a new policy to do something about this. And the policy that I know of that's the best around that can be used to guide this transformation into better fuels is something called the Low Carbon Fuel Standard. California adopted it 2 or 3 years ago. It's in the process of implementing it. There is a little side note there that the oil industry has sued, not only the oil industry, but the corn ethanol industry has sued California to try to block it. And so, you know, painfully I have to say, you know, one of the most promising professions in this country is the law. There's lots of jobs and more jobs. The downside of that is the rest of us, you know, all these lawsuits and all this litigious approach is really creates a much higher cost, slows things down. Sometimes it does it for good, but a lot of times not. And so we adopted in California, the European Union has adopted a program very similar to this as well. There's a number of states that are seriously considering it, including Washington, Oregon, some of the other states. And this is just the idea. You know, I'm not going to get into the details of it. I'd love to, you know, that's my policy law nature. But very simply, what it says, it tells the oil companies they have to reduce the carbon intensity of their fuel that they sell by 10% by 2020. And we don't care how you do it. You can add biofuels into your fuel, ethanol or some other kind of low carbon fuel. You can sell natural gas, you can sell electricity, it's like propane. Or you can buy credits from an electricity supplier that's selling electricity to electric vehicles, or any other company that's doing any of those things. So there's a lot of flexibility. It's performance-based because we don't tell them how to do it. And one of the good things about policy, or some policies, is we are moving towards more performance-based approaches as opposed to trying to pick winners and pick losers. And so, you know, we are moving in that direction, and this is an example of it. And so this provides a framework. So now every oil company knows it's got to reduce the carbon intensity, and they've got a time frame, and those current lawyers didn't get in the way. They know what the deadlines would be. And so we're moving forward, and different parts of the world are as well. So I'm pretty sure this is a policy that eventually is going to be adopted more broadly. Yes?
Is that 10% reduction in the full life cycle reduction? Or?
Yes. So one of the interesting parts of this is the first major policy in the world, I believe, that uses a life cycle concept as part of it. And what that means is, like with the electric vehicle, you know, I said it's zero emission, but it's not really, because there's all that emissions from where the electricity is produced. And just the gasoline, when you make gasoline from the refinery, there's emissions just because you're transporting the fuel. There's a lot of energy used for that. Just taking it out of the ground. There's lots of, you know, upstream, there's lots of emissions. And so that's a life cycle. And we're using that life cycle concept here. But we're going to do more and more of that as we get into greenhouse gases and climate policy. You have to do that. You have to look at the whole life cycle. And so we're going to see more and more of these kinds of policies. Yes?
I was just wondering, with the credit trading part of the policies, do you think that's something that's going to like stay in future policies like for a long time to come? Because it doesn't, I mean, as much as it makes sense now, because you have to give incentive for people to reduce carbon, it's not really a sustainable idea into the future because it still allows far too much pollution to happen and people just buy it off. Do you think that's something that would eventually get faded out of policy, or does that kind of have to stay?
Okay, so I hear where you're coming from. But so there's different ways of responding. So the way it works here is that it'll be, so every year, think of it, every year they have to reduce it by 1% until they get to 10%, and then at some point we'll adopt new numbers. So this is a trajectory all the way into the future. So the credit trading means that it really just gives them flexibility. If they can't do it fast enough, or it's too hard, or it's too expensive, they can buy it. But every year it's getting, the target is getting tighter and tighter. And so so your concern doesn't happen because of it. If you just didn't tighten it up, then that might be, but we're tightening it up every year. Yes?
But isn't it true that they're buying credits from companies that are zero emission? And so like Tesla, for example, that is only makes electric vehicles, so they'll have credits to sell. They aren't paying to pollute.
That's right. So that's right, because there has to be emission reduction somewhere. So this isn't kind of, you know, hot air type credits that we used to talk about. These are real reductions.
It's a reduction by someone else that they're using to cover their reduction.
From my point of view, that's fine. I don't care who does it as long as it happens, right? And, you know, if you did it with local air pollution, you might be more concerned because... Bye-bye. It's those darn batteries again. So... in local air pollution, you're very concerned about where it happens because, you know, it might be a neighborhood, you know, tend to be usually poor neighborhoods where you're going to have all the pollution right there because everyone else is selling, you know, the credit. But in this case, we don't care where the greenhouse gases are emitted in the world. This is a global polluting. It's not a local thing. So that's why, you know, who cares where it happens as long as it happens.
And isn't it also fair to say that the industries that have developed as a result of this are in business because of the credits? So if you had no policy and no credits, you wouldn't have a Tesla Motors, for example.
Right.
I mean, is that a fair?
Right, that's exactly right. So it's a motivation for innovation. It spurs innovation because now, so like if Exxon doesn't want to do anything, and then they can buy credits from someone, and okay, so if, you know, some biofuel or electricity supplier is willing and able to do it, then they get paid off, basically they get funding, and it helps them. So it helps all these smaller companies and all the ones doing more innovative things. So just to straighten out a little confusion, so you were asking the question, you kept saying Tesla, but in fact, we keep the vehicles separate from the fuels in the policy process. So in fact, for the fuels, for the LCFS, fuel standard, they can only buy it from the electricity supplier. On the vehicle side, we have a similar thing where, you know, General Motors could buy credits, you know, from Tesla, but those are two, it's the same idea, but two separate markets. Whoops, you didn't see the next one. So the third leg, so I went to the most optimistic, positive story and to the most frustrating one, and that is us. There was some of you have been around a little longer like me, might remember a comic strip from the early 70s called Pogo. And there was a Pogo comic strip, and then a book came out of it that said, "I have seen the enemy, and he is us." And that's kind of being a little, you know, overstating it. But really it is. In the end, it's us that need to change our behavior. I mean, partly in terms of the vehicles we drive, but also in terms of how much we drive. And of course, we're not going to just change our behavior just because, you know, it's good. You know, we have lifestyles, and, you know, we want to get places and so on. So it is part of the whole land use urban system. But we've gone, it's what I was saying about California has gone to the extreme in creating a very car-dependent city, car-dependent living. You know, for most people, there is no other option, a realistic option. You can't walk, I mean, many neighborhoods don't even have sidewalks anymore. You know, never mind bicycling or even public transit is not where the in the United States today, let me ask you, what percent of passenger travel do you think is by mass transit, public transit? Out of all the traveling that we do, okay, how many think it's 10% or more? Pretty good audience here. How about 5 to 10%? Wow.
Let's get down. 2%. More.
Less than that.
It's 2%. It's about 2%. So, you know, in a larger sense, transit, you know, the cars have won the war. They vanquished transit. The only place transit really works in a significant way is in very dense cities and mostly for commuter trips. So I'm living in Washington, D.C. now, and I use the metro there, and it works great, but there's not very many places like that. And that has pretty good density there to support it. So we've created a transportation system. I call it a monoculture because we all depend on cars to get around, and it's even worse than that. So it's all cars serve all purposes. So we don't specialize our vehicles. You know, we have SUVs to go down around the corner to, you know, pick up our six pack of beer. Just like we do to, from people in the Bay Area come up here, so we don't specialize our vehicles. We don't have, for instance, neighborhood vehicles for that local trip and then another vehicle. After all, we already, in the United States today, we already own more than one vehicle per licensed driver. We have 1.15 vehicles per licensed driver. We got plenty of vehicles. Most households have fleets of vehicles now. And they could very easily specialize their vehicles. But we've created a system where all vehicles are expected to serve all purposes, all roads serve all vehicles. So it would be dangerous to drive a neighborhood vehicle on the road. So you have to specialize the roads more, specialize the vehicles. And we can come up with all kinds of new transit services that actually could be better than a car-based system. You know, think about it. Is it really that getting in a car and driving it is really our ultimate desire, fulfills us so much? Take an example. I mean, wouldn't you rather be chauffeured, as an example? I mean, if someone came and picked you up and took you where you're going, wouldn't that be better? Wouldn't it be better if you had access to different vehicles, and if you wanted to go take a drive around the lake in a sports car, you had access to a sports car? If you needed something to, you know, carry a bunch of stuff around, you had access to a pickup truck, but that you didn't have. And so that, you know, that you would have essentially a whole large fleet, but access to it, you wouldn't have to own it all. You know, that idea is car sharing. And if we could expand the concept of car sharing, where you had easy access to a lot of different vehicles when you needed it, that would be better than what you have. If you had some service that came and picked you up, took you where you wanted to go, even if it took a little bit longer, you'd probably prefer that. Maybe up here in Nevada, you know, not so much. But if you were living in a, you know, a more congested area, or if you're, you know, living in a, you know, as you get older and more decrepit, you can't drive very well anymore, drive at night, if you could get access to some of these services, would that be a lot better? And to do that, we could do that at the same or less cost than the transportation system we have now. There's the idea of demand response and transit. You know, it used to be called dial-a-ride. You know, now we've upgraded because we have better computers and so on. That you can, through your cell phone or whatever, you can just say, okay, I'm ready to leave in 5 minutes, and I'm going so-and-so, just pop it in. And a van would come and pick you up, and it might have one or two other people there, and would drop them off. But there'd be this, you know, computer system that would optimize all the routing. And if you had a lot of these vehicles, you could make it work. And people would willingly give up at least one of their vehicles if they had access to these other services. So it's not that we have the best, you know, optimal transportation system right now. We can do it better, cheaper, less environmental impact, less energy. But the real problem is getting from the middle. And, you know, it's the infrastructure, it's locked in, we have rules, we have driver license rules, we have rules about how roads are used, we have safety, crash test rules for vehicles that don't allow much flexibility in different types of vehicles. It goes on and on and on. And the other part of the problem is there are a lot of companies providing these other kinds of services, but they're going up with startup companies, and it's a real challenge going up against the car. And so you really need a suite of these services before you're going to be willing to give up your car. So you need the demand responsive, you know, van and the neighborhood vehicle and car sharing for most of us, access to all of that before we're willing to give up a car. So it's a real problem how to get from here to there, but that's what we're doing. Okay, yes?
Is there anything happening in terms of automated, like, traffic monitoring through computer systems to reduce emissions and increase reduce travel times through smart technology?
Well, there's all kinds of technology available, being developed, and even used for all kinds of transportation things. You know, it's like the demand responsive. I mean, that's really using intelligent transportation systems, you know, reservation, online, optimizing the routes, on a real-time basis. You have traffic management, where we know where the traffic congestion is, we can send a message to someone to go around it. So you have a GPS in your car, the next GPS in your car is going to have real-time traffic information in it, and it'll tell you, okay, I mean, now you can go on it, there's apps on your phone, on your smartphone, you can get, from Microsoft, Google, that tell you, you know, where the traffic congestion is. They don't give you a lot of information about exactly, you know, on the route. It's very easy to do. So that'll be coming into our cars. So there's lots and lots of innovations. And most of the innovations are very incremental, making it a little easier to drive, find a parking place. You know, you can go come to a parking area and it'll tell you, you know, where there's an open parking spot. So that all that kind of stuff is being developed. But the really transformational part, that's not happening very fast. And that's the car sharing, the demand response of the neighborhood cars, and so on. So this is actually a slide more for my Washington, D.C. Audiences. Because you go to Washington, D.C., you know, the politicians, they say, it's a right of all Americans to have a car and drive whenever and wherever they want. And my response to that is, well, maybe. But, you know, there's a lot of trips that are taken. They're not exactly high priority. I mean, if that person, you know, got out of the car and walked with their dog, first of all, it would be better in so many. They'd be healthier. They'd use less energy. So, I mean, this is kind of extreme. But it makes the point that there's a lot of trip making that we do that's not really high priority or high value. So one of the other innovations in California in terms of policy, so I said, you know, it's kind of like California's atonement for its sins, you know, a pioneering car-centric, car dependency. So we've got this law now passed a few years ago that we're just in the process of starting to implement that tells every city that they must reduce the amount of emissions associated with passenger travel. They must reduce the amount of vehicle use in the cities. And the targets are, right now, are 6 to 8% reduction per person by 2020, and about 15% reduction per person by 2035. And so we're just starting to implement it. All the major city, all the major metropolitan areas have their target, and they're starting to develop their plans of how they're going to do it. And they can do it, they can improve public transportation, they can use pricing to discourage the, you know, the less valuable trip making and to encourage, you know, changing behavior. They can use it to change land use patterns so people don't have to drive as much. So we're not telling them what to do, we're just telling the cities you gotta do something. And so that's, I think that's a good policy innovation that, you know, I hope to see spread around the rest of the country and the rest of the world.
We are getting on top of the younger
same. So I meant to ask someone about that. So, you know, we are overseeing that. So we negotiated a target for every area. Is there a target reduction for TRPA?
Yes.
For
yes. Do you clarify in SB 575 that the Tahoe NPO, which is a virtual NPO, has the same SB 575 targets.
Okay.
Okay. We are doing that even as we speak.
All right, bravo. So, you know, I've already told you a story. You know, California's taking a lot of initiative here. These are just all the this is a summary of everything I told you about, kind of a timeline when these policies and rules and so on have been adopted. See, it goes back to 2002 with the vehicle, starting it with the vehicle emissions and greenhouse gases for vehicle, you know, going all the way up. This is the SB 375 in 2008, is the one we've just been talking about. The low carbon fuel standard in 2009. Cap and trade was adopted last year, 2 years ago. And then here's a box for responding to the one about electricity. So in California, we require now that by 2020, 33% of electricity must be made from renewable energy. And most states in the country actually have a rule similar to that. Most of them not as aggressive, but they're doing the same thing. So this is for the academics and the economists in the audience. I'm just flashing it up there because many people will say, and this is also probably for the Washington crowd more than others, is why do we have to do all this stuff? Why don't we just, you know, have have a carbon tax, or just, isn't there something simple we can do? And the answer is, kind of like I was, how I was talking to you earlier about the zero, the justification of a zero emission vehicle permit. There are all of these market failures, market flaws, market conditions that inhibit innovation, inhibit investments in a way that results in change being much slower than what's in the public interest. So the vehicles, let me just give you one example of that. So these new 54 mile per gallon standards, now you say, wow, that's going to be really expensive. It's going to cost consumers all this money. And in fact, you know, the analysis is that it will cost about $2,000 extra for a vehicle in 2025. But along the way, you're going to be saving so much money from fuel that it's 2 to 3 times as much money is saved as it's going to cost you. Even if you look at it in a kind of year-by-year basis, since people normally use a vehicle lease, they, you know, when you get or a vehicle financing, so when you pay, you know, your financing for a month for, say, for $2,000, the amount of extra you pay, $50 or $60 extra, you'll save more than that every month in fuel. So here's an example of a regulation that by itself will result in not only benefits the environment and everything else, but benefits the consumer. But the problem is consumers don't behave that way. We know that when we go buy a car that, you know, we don't want to be investing for the long term. We, you know, if it costs more, I better get my money back in about 2 years, or I'm not going to pay that extra amount. So this is kind of helping people move in the right direction. Yes?
You're in Washington, right?
For 2 more months.
Okay. How about we get
that's all I can take.
How about we stop letting the oil companies screw us? How about that for policy?
Well, I told you that the oil industry is the problem right now. And we need to, and that's what the low carbon. So my best answer to that, I mean, there's different things I can do, but for the long haul, or you know, to get us on a different trajectory, I think the low carbon fuel standard is the best way to do that. I mean, there's other ways, you know, there's tax credits we're getting and so on, but we need them to behave in a fundamentally different way. And the way they see it is they have no reason to behave in a different way. They're making lots of money, thank you, and there's no policy that forces them or even motivates them to do it any differently. So that's the problem. But, you know, from my point of view as a policy, I want to change this policy and change the behavior. And yes, they are the problem. So anyway, so these are all the things. So each of those is a good, you know, master's piece of So this is kind of bringing it all together. But it is. I mean, what California is doing is pretty remarkable in some of these policies. You know, California's screwed up a lot of things. There are a lot of things bad, but this is one area in terms of climate policies where it's really putting in place a lot of good policies. It's really created a model for the rest of the world. And now we've got to figure out how to actually make it work before we get swept away. So, thank you very much.
So as a manifestation of just what you're talking about, you are in Washington, D.C. at this particular time, so the House version of transportation, modernization, legislation, H.R. 7, is all about, you know, getting more oil forward as a mechanism to pay for transportation. So the bill actually, which kind of fell apart here the last couple of days, is now being divided up into parts to try to sneak them through a lower level. But just today they announced that they're actually not going to divide them. But it really is all about using oil revenues to pay for transportation. And it's kind of interesting that the rural parts of the country were the ones that pushed back on the portion of the bill that threw out dedicated funding for public transit. But actually now it's the rural areas of the country that of course being the House Republicans are putting that back in. But there's no funding for bike trails, no funding for any sort of mobility. The only sort of enhancements that are going to be funded are funding in areas that are eligible for CMAQ. So, I mean, it's basically taking the last, you know, 15 to 20 years of progressive transportation multimodal policy, throwing it out the window in favor of doing everything that you just said we shouldn't do. And so, you know, you're in Washington, D.C. at a time when, you know, transportation policy is being completely unraveled by that very small portion of people who are not the educated part of the world that understands something has to be done. And, you know, it's a tragedy. It's an absolute tragedy and embarrassment. And yet, you know, it's very difficult to try to convince those few folks that they're going down the wrong road because it's politics and not common sense.
It really is indicative of the problem in Washington, D.C. It's symptomatic because everything you said, and fix this. So, you know, because transportation is an example. I had it put over here so I could work for you. It's a good example. Transportation, investment in transportation, infrastructure, transit, it's always been a nonpartisan issue. It's always been all the bills that went through Congress always were passed with a huge majority. And now even that's become a partisan thing. And it's everything has become partisan. And you know, it's really sad what's happening. And when I'm in Washington, I go to the dinner parties and come to people are really involved in politics directly, and you say, you know, do you see any light at the end of the tunnel? Is going to get better? And, you know, the most optimistic ones will come up with some weak thoughts, but it's pretty grim in Washington. So one of the responses to that is we do have to bring things back to the state level and be doing, you know, a lot of the innovation, a lot of the good things has to be done at the local level and state level, because right now it's not happening. Anything more upbeat?
In your last 2 months in Washington, D.C., I think you should work on that light rail around the lake. Yeah, I'll give you an example. The World's Fair in Seattle was in 62, and they had a monorail that went from downtown Seattle to the fairgrounds. Just last year, they did the monorail that went from downtown to the airport. Only took them 50 years, okay? Now, if we're going to get the Olympics here, it's going to be 60 years by the time we get the light rail. So push him on that idea.
Well, given that I was working on the light rail 30 years ago, things are slow here too, everywhere.
Yeah. But it's unfortunate that we don't have the density to support that. And the further unfortunate thing is because Tahoe is losing permanent population, we're going to be getting less money from California and the Transportation Development Act. So we'll get less money for public transit starting this next fiscal cycle because our permanent population has gone down by about 10,000 over the last, you know, 10 years. So we're going to be getting less money for public transit. So we're actually trying to make a case in Sacramento that they should give us an allocation of PDA that would recognize our visitor population, not just our permanent population. But that's a very, you know, steep uphill battle.
Yeah, one of the perverse parts of these policies, and we're working with this SB 375 law, we're trying to work at it from that direction, is that right now, if you have more people driving more, you get more money. I've got an innovative idea. What about if you reduce your vehicle use, you get more money? What a novel concept. So actually, that's what we are.
Yeah, and a good example of that is the CMAQ. There's only one portion of the basin that's eligible for CMAQ, and that's Colorado County and the city on the California side of South Shore. And that's where even the Senate bill, not putting on the Environment and Public Works Committee version of the bill, you only get to have money for bike trails if you're in a CMAQ area. So you're exactly right. If you flip that around and reward good behavior and say, you know, that's what they're doing it all perversely. So Both the House and the Senate bills are very badly in terms of unraveling 20 years of transportation.
So he's gotten much more into the weeds than I ever did. But but thank you. But you know, one idea behind the SB 375 is it's creating a framework for turning it around. The problem is everything in the policy world, the regulatory world, the finance, public finances, You know, everything is a little fragmented thing here or there, and it's got a history. If we can come up with a whole framework that is providing, provides a performance metric, provides an incentive to cities to behave different, and then we can fold in the financing mechanisms to that, now we've come up with a real revolution that really makes sense. And the low carbon fuel standard is analogous to that. Again, it's providing a target, and then we can tie the incentives and everything else to that for good behavior, to reward good behavior. You know, that's kind of not been the way things are done, but yes.
I need to know from someone in the policy world why there's a disconnect between different transportation systems, like for instance the TART in the north side and the south shore, why you can't get north to south. Now why would I give up a vehicle to travel on a bus when I can't even get around the lake, let alone the Reno or different places? I mean, it makes no sense. You're pretty much trapped in Tahoe. Now how are we going to have
change? I'll give you the broader answer to that. Is that, you know, government is very complicated in the sense that we've divided up, we create all these little fiefdoms and jurisdictions, and they don't always talk to each other very well and work together. And somehow, and that's again, the 375 is part of the motivation for that, is treat the whole basin. You know, it's a little more complicated here because you've got two states, but ideally treat it all as one. And create a mechanism to reward the different operators and the different cities to work together so that they all benefit. You know, now there's not the reward system built into it. There's more specific detail. Why don't you talk to the gentleman up here after I know he has the answer for
you. I actually do.
Yes.
So will light trucks and SUVs be brought into the same fuel efficiency standards as
Yes. Well, we actually treat cars and what we call light trucks separately, but they follow a parallel path. So the 54 mpg is average for both of them. The cars will be, you know, better than 54 trucks, but they all have to improve at that, you know, roughly that same trajectory, which is very good. You have a question back there.
Okay, like Steve was saying about the situation up here. Are you working on policy then to work? Are you reversing that?
For the, that is exactly the so-called SB 375. I think we're building up to that, but right now we're just getting all the targets and everything in place, and what we're starting to work with is how to create the incentive system to reward it. So the, you know, the two big ideas are, one is you change transportation financing the way I just talked about, is, you know, if you do good, you get more. And the other way is in California with the cap and trade program, that's going to generate a lot of revenue. And so one idea is to take some of that revenue and use that to reward the cities. So some, basically, you know, cities are essentially bankrupt. They don't have any money. They can't do anything unless you provide funding. The good news on that is it's very easy to bribe them because they have so little money that you don't have to dangle very much.
What's the expectation?
I can see that resonated with you. Yes.
Could you comment, what do you think about James Hansen's idea about the fee at the point of a production for carbon? Do you think that has merit? Do you think it's realistic?
Well, the idea of a carbon tax more generally is a great idea. I mean, if you're an economist, you would think that naturally, because it's the idea that it's a source of pollution, it's external to the market system, so just make everyone pay for the pollution they're causing, they'll change their behavior and they'll reduce it. And I think that's, so it's a great idea. Politically, it's, you know, you can't do anything that's called a tax. You know, you can call it a fee, but usually doesn't work either. So there's the political challenge of it, but it is a good idea. But it is still, it's not nearly as simple and straightforward as people like to communicate. And that's part of what I've learned being in the real world of policy and regulations, is everything turns out to be far more complex. But it's certainly, it's a good idea that should be pursued, but it's basically the same as cap and trade. It's a slightly, you know, it's a little simpler version of cap and trade, but it basically does the same thing. So I think cap and trade is good enough, and you know, we ought to, and that hides it, you know, we make believe it's not a tax. So, you know, if that, if the politicians can do that, then okay, I'll go along with it. Yes?
You have something like, you talked about the manufacturers of the vehicles, like the GM Volt, for example. Look at how many of those they produce. It's almost like it's almost a joke, because they, once they make it, they make fewer of them, and make them expensive. So they're really, and if you talk to dealers about it, they have one in the showroom, but they know you're not going to buy that car. You're going to come and buy something else. So it's sort of like, you know, a dangle out there, but they didn't even make enough to satisfy the demand that would be there. Plus they price it so.
There is this concept of a halo car, or halo technology. And Toyota is the one that really showed how important that is with the Prius. So even though for many years they were losing money with the Prius, it was fabulous for the company, because now all of a sudden, this stodgy company that, you know, it was pretty good on fit and finish and, you know, quality, but it wasn't an environmental company, it wasn't a high-tech company. All of a sudden, it was this environmental, high-tech, cool company, and so they started selling a huge number of cars. They could even sell a big pickup truck and get away with it, and because they were doing the Prius. And so all the companies now have come to embrace the idea of having a halo car. So that's what Nissan did with the Leaf. That's what GM is doing with the Volt. And the others are trying to figure out what, you know, what they can do for have a halo car. I mean, after a while, you run out of types of halo, you know, things that become halos anymore. But GM, I mean, you know, they did do it. And you're right, they're not producing in very large volumes. And it's hard to know how much demand there really is for it. But now that we've got these performance standards and the ZEV mandate in place, that it's going to push them in that direction. So hopefully there'll be more out there. Yes?
What was the basic reason that the GM electric car that was out on trial was taken off the market? I was just curious.
The EV one, so back in, you know, the 90s, they made this car that was a very elegant, technically very sophisticated, good looking. But GM lost faith in electric vehicles, basically. And they only sold 1,000 altogether. And they only leased 1,000 of them. And they had the concern that if they left them on those 1,000 on the road, then they have to be responsible for maintaining them, and the batteries would die. And they just didn't think the batteries were good enough. So the original EV ones actually used a lead acid battery, and they really didn't last very long. The latter ones used nickel metal hydride, but even nowadays we consider that you know, a very costly, low performing battery. So, you know, to some extent it was legitimate in that the batteries really were expensive. The cars really weren't commercial to a mass market. They really were expensive to produce. But they had such a good technology. Now, they kick themselves now because they know they really screwed up. That would have been the halo car. That would have been their halo car if they followed through with it.
I just also want to mention that Tobias has a box of the book, 2 Billion Cars, and I don't want to keep Dr. Sperling here all night and keep everyone here all night, so I wanted to leave it open for people who want to come ask questions, but let's please give him a big, huge round of applause.